Hail. The words again had the hollow ring of learned repetition. Fork cut him off. How do you know? Deacon, tell me. Why have you always been so sure Luke and I weren't together the day she died? Because I tell you, from here, it seems like you know a lot more about that day than you've let on. There was no smell of dinner in the air when Mal Deacon let himself into the farmhouse, and he felt a hot flash of irritation. In the living room, his nephew was lying on the old brown couch with his eyes closed and a beer can balanced on his gut. The cricket was blaring from the radio. The Aussies were chasing the South African side. Deacon kicked Grant's boots off the couch and his nephew prized open one eye. No bloody tea on yet, Deacon said. Ellie's not back from school. You couldn't have started something, you lazy bastard, or been out there up to my eyes with those ewes all day. Grant shrugged. Ellie's job. Deacon grunted. But he was right, it was. He snapped a beer from the six-pack by Grant's side and went through to the rear of the house. His daughter's bedroom was clinically neat. It stood silent and almost aloof from the chaos of the rest of the house. Deacon stood in the doorway and took a swig from the can. His eyes roamed over the room like beetles, but he was hesitant to step inside. Poised at the threshold of the pristine room, he felt the uneasy sensation of misalignment. A loose thread, a crack in the pavement. It looked perfect, but it wasn't right. His eyes flicked to the white bedpost, and he frowned. There was a tiny, circular dent in the wood, and the paint there had cracked and flaked. The pink carpet below the post had been scrubbed in a small and imperfect circle, and was now one, or at most two, shades darker than the rest. Barely noticeable, but there. Deacon felt a cold spot form in his stomach, like a tiny ball bearing. He stared at the silent room, and the dent and the spot as the alcohol carried the first threads of anger through his veins. His daughter was supposed to be there, and she wasn't. He clutched the beer in his palm and waited for its cool, solid weight to calm him. Later, he would tell the police that was the moment he knew something was seriously wrong. Fork watched Ellie's father closely. "You might be able to claim your hands are clean when it comes to the Hadlers," Fork said, "but you know something about what happened to your daughter."
"You watch your mouth."
Deacon's voice was quiet and tight, like a coiled spring. "Is that why you were always so keen to pin Ellie's death on me? If there's no suspect to hand, people start looking for one. Who knows what they'd start to uncover if they looked too closely at you? Neglect? Abuse?" The old man lunged at Fork with surprising force, taking him by surprise and knocking him flat to the ground. Deacon's grubby hand mashed against his face. The dog circled, barking frantically.
"I will gut you!"
Deacon was shouting now.
"I hear you breathe one word like that and I will gut you like an animal. I loved her, you hear me? I love that girl!"
Luke Hadler's heart was in his throat. He paused with one hand on the radio as the South Africans nearly took a wicket. Batsman restored and panic over. He switched it off. He sprayed body mist liberally over his bare chest and flung open his wardrobe. Automatically, he reached for the grey shirt she'd admired once. Luke checked his reflection in the mirror and flashed his teeth as he buttoned it. He liked what he saw, but he knew from experience that meant bugger all. It took a mind reader to know what was going through those girls' heads half the time. Today, for example, the image of Ellie pressing her hot, mean mouth on Aaron in the classroom popped into his head, and his reflection frowned. Was that the first time it had happened? Somehow he felt sure it wasn't. Luke felt an intense flash of something like jealousy and gave his head a sharp shake. What did he care? He didn't give a stuff. But Jesus, Ellie Deacon could be a little bitch sometimes. Ignoring him and then running off to Aaron? Not that it bothered him, but Christ, you only had to look at that picture to know there was something seriously wrong. Deacon's long fingers gouged painfully against the flesh of Fork's cheek, and Fork grabbed his wrist, wrenching him off. He flipped Deacon onto his back and stood up, stepping away. It was over in a matter of seconds, but both men were panting, the adrenaline kicking into overdrive. Deacon stared up at him, the corners of his mouth white with spit. Falk leaned over him, ignoring the dog as it bared its teeth. He stood over an ill man lying on the ground. Later he would hate himself for it. At that moment, he didn't care. Aaron's arms were aching under the box of plants by the time he got home, but the grin was still fixed on his face. His good mood was tempered only by a pang of mild regret. Maybe he should have followed Ellie out of the classroom. That's what Luke would have done, he thought. Kept the conversation flowing, convinced her she did want that coke after all. He frowned and dumped the box on the porch. Ellie had definitely smiled at Luke as she left the room. They were barely speaking these days, but she still managed to smile for him. Aaron had braced himself for a smirk and a cheeky comment from his friend after Ellie left, but Luke had merely raised his eyebrows. "Careful with that one," was all he'd said. Aaron had suggested they head to the main street, hang around for a while, but Luke had shaken his head. "Sorry, mate, got somewhere to be." Ellie had said she was busy too. Doing what? Aaron wondered. If she was working, she would have said, wouldn't she? He forced himself not to wonder too hard what both his friends were doing without him. Instead, for something to do, he fetched his fishing poles. He'd head to the river, upstream where the fish had been biting. Or, he thought suddenly, he could go to the rock tree, just in case Ellie was there. He debated. If she'd wanted to see him, she would have said. But she was so difficult to read. Maybe if they spent a bit more time together one-on-one, she'd realise he would be good for her. If he couldn't even make her see that, something was seriously wrong. "You think I killed your daughter that day?" Falk said, looking down at Deacon. "You think I held her body underwater until she drowned, then lied to everyone, to my own dad, all these years? I don't know what happened that day." "I think you do." "I loved her." "Since when," Falk said, "has that ever stopped anybody from hurting someone?" "Give me a bloody clue then. On a scale of one to jail, how much shit have you stirred up?" Rako was shouting down the phone. Falk realised he'd never really heard him angry before. "None. Look, it's fine. Leave it," Falk said. He was sitting in the police car a kilometre down the road from Deacon's place. He'd had 8 missed calls on his phone from Rako. "None?" Rako said. "You think I came down in the last shower, mate? You got a complaint against you. You think I can't guess exactly where you are? I'm just some thick country plod who hasn't got a clue." "What?" Falk said. "No, Rako, mate, of course not." He was shaken up by his own lack of control. It felt wrong, like he was wearing a costume. "You bugger off the minute the interview's over. I know you listened in, by the way. And I can hear in your voice you've been up to something with Deacon. In a police car. So it's not fine, is it? I'm still in charge around here, last I checked. And if you've been harassing someone who's already complained... for God's sake, then we've one serious problem, mate." There was a long silence. Falk could imagine Rako pacing around the station with Deborah and Barnes listening in. Falk took a few deep breaths. His heart was still pounding, but common sense was starting to return. "We haven't got a problem," Falk said. "I'm sorry, I snapped for a minute. If there's any fallout, I'll cop it, not you. Promise." The line was silent for so long, Falk wasn't sure if Rako was still there. "Listen, mate." Rako's voice was lower. "I think all this might be getting too much for you, with your background here." Falk shook his head, even though there was no one to see it. "No, I told you, it was a moment of madness. No harm done." "No further harm, anyway." "Look, you've done everything that could have been asked of you. More," Rako was saying. "We've got further than I ever would have alone. I absolutely know that, mate. But maybe it's time we called it a day. Calling Clyde. I blame myself for that. I should have done it ages ago. This isn't your responsibility. It never was. Rako, mate, and you're obsessed with Deacon and Dow. You're obsessed with pointing the finger at them. It's as if you need to get them for the Hadlers to make up for whatever happened to Ellie. It's not about that. Dow's name was in Karen's handwriting. I know, but there's no other evidence. They've got an alibi, both of them now. Rako sighed down the phone. Deacon's phone call at the time of the Hadler shootings looks like it's legit. Barnes is getting the phone records now, but the girl from the pharmacy has backed him up. She remembers it happening. Shit. Falk ran a hand over his head. Why didn't she mention it before? She was never asked. There was a pause. Deacon didn't do it, Rako said. He didn't kill the Hadlers. You need to open your eyes and fast. You're staring so hard at the past that it's blinding you.
Chapter 32. Falk felt the tension in his shoulders finally start to lift around the time Gretchen poured the third glass of red. A weight that had pressed on his chest for so long that he'd almost stopped noticing at last began to ease. He could feel muscles in his neck loosen. He took a mouthful of wine and enjoyed the sensation as his cluttered head gave way to a more pleasant type of fog. The kitchen was now dark, the remains of dinner cleared from the table. A lamb stew. Her own, she'd said. Animal, not recipe. They'd washed the dishes together, her hands deep in suds, his wrapped around a tea towel. Working together in tandem and revelling self-consciously in the domesticity. Eventually they'd moved through to the living room where he'd sunk, satiated, into a deep old couch, glass in hand. He'd watched her move around the room slowly, turning on low lights on side tables, creating a deep golden glow. She hit an invisible switch and discreet jazz filled the room. Something mellow and indistinct. The maroon curtains were open, flapping in the night breeze. Outside the windows, the land was still. Earlier, Gretchen had picked him up from the pub in her car. "What happened to yours?" she'd asked. He'd told her about the damage. She'd insisted on seeing it. And they'd walked to the car park where she'd gingerly lifted the tarpaulin. The car had been hosed down, but the inside was still destroyed. She'd been sympathetic, laughed gently as she rubbed his shoulder. She made it seem not as bad. As they'd driven along the back roads, Gretchen told him Lockie was sleeping at the babysitter's overnight. No further explanation. In the moonlight, her blonde hair gleamed. Now she joined him on the couch. Same couch, at the other end. A distance he would have to breach. He always found that bit difficult, reading the signs, judging it just right. Too early and it caused offence, too late the same. She smiled. Maybe he wouldn't find it too difficult tonight, he thought. You're still managing to resist the call of Melbourne then, she said. She took a sip. The wine was the same colour as her lips. Some days it's easier than others, Falk said. He smiled back. He could feel a warmth bloom in his chest, his belly, lower. Any sign of wrapping things up? Honestly, it's hard to say, he said, vague. He didn't want to talk about the case. She nodded, and they lapsed into a comfortable silence. The blue notes of the jazz were swallowed up by the heat. Hey, she said, I've got something to show you. She twisted around, reaching up to the bookshelves behind the couch. The movement brought her close, exposing a flash of smooth torso. Gretchen flopped back, holding two photo albums, big books with thick covers. She opened the first page of one, then discarded it, putting it off to the side. She opened the other. Scooted closer to Falk. The distance breached already. He hadn't even finished his glass. I found this the other day, she said. He glanced at it. He could feel her bare arm on his. It reminded him of the day he'd seen her again for the first time, outside the funeral. No, he didn't want to think about that now, not about the Hadlers, not about Luke. Falk looked down as she opened the album. It had three or four photos to a sticky page, covered with a plastic sheet. The first few pictures showed Gretchen as a small child, the images bright with the hallmark red and yellow tones of a chemist's developing room. She flipped through. Where is... Ah, here. See? She said, tilting the page towards him and pointing. Fork leaned in. It was him. And her. A picture he'd never seen before. 30 years ago. Him bare-legged in grey shorts, her wearing a too-large school dress. They were side by side amid a small group of uniformed kids. The others were all smiling, but both he and Gretchen were squinting suspiciously at the camera. Childhood blondes. Hers lit with gold, his white. Posed under duress at the instruction of the person behind the camera, Falk guessed, judging by his mutinous expression. First day of school, I think. Gretchen looked sideways and raised an eyebrow. So, it would appear that in fact you and I were friends before anyone else. He laughed and leaned in a little as she ran a finger over the image from the past. She looked up at him in the present, red lips, parting in a smile over white teeth, and then they were kissing. His arm around her back pulled her in closer, and her mouth was hot on his nose against her cheek, his other hand in her hair. Her chest was soft on his, and he was keenly conscious of her denim skirt pressed against his thighs. They broke away, an awkward laugh, a deep breath. Her eyes were almost navy in the low light. He brushed a strand of hair from her forehead. Then she was moving in again, closer, kissing him, the scent of her shampoo and the taste of red wine in every breath. He didn't hear the mobile ring. Only when she stopped moving did he register anything outside of the two of them. He tried to ignore it, but she held a finger to his lips. He kissed it. Shh, she giggled. Is that yours or... No, it's mine. Sorry. Leave it, he said. But she was already moving, pushing herself up out of the couch, away from him. I can't. I'm sorry. It might be the babysitter. She smiled, a little witchy smile that made his skin tingle where she'd been. He could still feel her. She looked at the screen. It is. I'll be back. Make yourself comfortable. She actually winked, a playful, ironic nod to what was to come. He grinned as she left the room. Hi, Andrea. Everything okay? He heard her say. He blew out his cheeks, rubbed his eyes with his knuckles, shook his head, took a slug of wine, sat up straighter on the couch. Waking up a little, but not too much, trying not to break the spell, anticipating her return. Gretchen's voice was a low murmur in the other room. He leaned his head back on the couch, listening to the indistinct sounds. He could hear the cadence, up and down, soothing. Yes, the thought popped into his head unbidden. Maybe he could almost get used to this. Not in Kiwara, but somewhere else. Somewhere grassy and open where it rained. He knew how to handle the wide open spaces. Melbourne and his real life seemed 5 hours and a million miles away. The city might have got under his skin, but for the first time he wondered what was hidden in his core. He shifted on the couch and his hand brushed against the cool covers of the photo albums. In the other room, Gretchen's voice was a dull murmur. No urgency in her tone. She was patient, explaining something. Falk pulled the album into his lap, opening it half-heartedly, blinking away the heaviness from the wine. He was looking for the photo of the two of them, but realised immediately he'd picked up the wrong album. Instead of the early childhood snaps on the first page, Gretchen was older in this one, 19 or 20 maybe. Falk started to close the cover, then stopped. He looked at the pictures with interest. He'd never really seen her at that age. He'd seen younger and now older, nothing in between. Gretchen was still looking a little suspiciously at the camera, but the reluctance to pose was gone. The skirt was shorter and the expression less coy. He turned the page and felt a jolt as he came face to face with Gretchen and Luke, frozen in time in a glossy colour print. Both in their early 20s, intimate and laughing, heads close, smiles matching. What had she said? We dated for a year or two, nothing serious. It fell apart, of course. A string of similar pictures spanned two double pages. Days out, holidays by the beach, a Christmas party. Then all of a sudden they stopped. As Luke's face was changing from a 20-something bloke to a man nearing 30. About the age Luke had met Karen, he disappeared from Gretchen's album. That was okay, Fork told himself. That was fine. It made sense. He flicked through the remaining pages as Gretchen's muffled voice floated through from the other room. He was about to close the book when his hand stilled. On the very last page, under the yellowing plastic protector, was a photo of Luke Hadler. He was looking down, away from the camera, with a serene smile on his face. The picture was cropped close, but he appeared to be in a hospital room, perched on the edge of a bed. In his arms, he held a newborn baby. The tiny pink face, dark hair and chubby wrist peeked out from the folds of a blue blanket in his arms. Luke held the child comfortably, closely, paternally. Billy, Fork thought automatically. He'd seen 1,000 similar photos at the Hadler's place. The name hit a dud note the moment it landed. Fork leaned in, over Gretchen's photo album, rubbing his eyes, wide awake now. The picture was not a good one, taken in a dim room with a heavy flash, but the focus was sharp. Fork shoved the album under the tableside lamp, the mood lighting revealing the image more clearly. Nestled in the blue blanket, circling the baby's fat wrist, was a white plastic bracelet. The child's name was written on it in neat capital letters. Lachlan Shona. Chapter 33. In the black windows, Fork could see his reflection warp and shift. Gretchen's voice drifted down the hall. It sounded suddenly different to his ears. He grabbed the other album and flicked through. Photos showed Gretchen alone, Gretchen with her mother on a night out in Sydney with her older sister. No Luke. Until he nearly missed it. He turned back a page. It was another bad photo, hardly worth including in an album, taken at some community event. Gretchen was in the background of the action. Standing next to her was Karen Hadler, and standing next to Karen was Luke. Over his wife's head, Luke Hadler was looking straight at Gretchen. She was looking back with the same little witchy smile that she'd just flashed at Fork. He turned to the photo of Luke with Gretchen's baby son. The son who, with his dark hair and brown eyes and sharp nose, had grown up to look nothing like his mother. Fork jumped as Gretchen spoke behind him. "It was nothing," she said. Fork spun round. She smiled, put down her mobile and picked up her wine glass. "Lockie just needed to hear my voice." Her smile faded as she saw the look on his face and the photo album open in his hand. She looked back at him, her expression a mask. Did Jerry and Barb Hadler know? Fork heard the edge in his own voice and didn't like it. Did Karen? She bristled, instantly defensive. "There's nothing to know, Gretchen. I told you. Lockie's dad's not around. Luke was an old friend, so he visited. Spent a couple of hours with Lockie now and again. So what? What's wrong with that? It was a male role model thing. It was nothing." Gretchen was babbling. She stopped. She took a deep breath, looked at Fork. "Luke's not his father." Fork said nothing. "He's not," she snapped. "What does it say on Lockie's birth certificate?" "It's blank, not that it's any of your business." "Have you got a single photo of Lockie's dad? One picture you can show me?" She met the question with silence. "Have you?" he said. "I don't have to show you anything." "Can't have been easy for you when Luke met Karen." Fork didn't recognize his own tone. It sounded distant and cold. "For God's sake, Aaron, he's not Lockie's father." Gretchen's face and neck were flushed. She took a slug of wine. A pleading note had crept into her voice. "We hadn't slept together for, Jesus, it had been years." "What happened? Luke didn't want to settle down with you?" has one eye on the road. Then he meets Karen and...
Yeah, and what?
She interrupted. The wine sloshed against the side of her glass. She blinked back tears and any earlier tenderness was gone.
Okay, yes, it pissed me off when he chose her. It hurt me. Luke hurt me, but that's life, isn't it? That's love.
She stopped, bit the tip of her tongue between her front teeth. I wondered why you didn't like Karen, Fork said. But that would well and truly do it, wouldn't it?
So? I don't have to be her best friend.
She had all the things you wanted. Luke, the security, the money, at least what there was of it. You were here on your own. Your child's father had moved on, left town allegedly. Or was he actually down the road playing dad and husband to other people?
Gretchen rounded on him, tears spilling over now.
How can you ask me this? If I had an affair with Luke while he was married, if he's the father of my son?
Fork stared at her. She had always been the beautiful one, almost ethereal. Then he remembered the stain in Billy Hadler's room. He remembered Gretchen raising her gun and shooting those rabbits down. I'm asking because I have to ask.
Jesus, what is wrong with you?
Her face had hardened. Her teeth were stained from the wine.
Are you jealous that for a while I chose Luke and he chose me? That's probably half the reason you're here now, isn't it? Thought you might finally manage to get one up on Luke now he's gone.
Don't be stupid, he said.
I'm stupid? God, look at you, she said, louder now. Always following him around when we were younger like a lapdog, and now, even now, you're hanging around in a town you hate because of him. It's pathetic. What kind of hold has he got over you? It's like you're obsessed.
Fork could almost feel the eyes of his dead friend watching them from that album. Jesus, Gretchen, I'm here because three people were killed, all right? So I hope for your son's sake that lying about your relationship with Luke is the worst thing you've done to that family. She pushed past him, knocking his wine glass off the table as she went. The stain seeped like blood into the carpet. She flung open the front door and a gust of hot wind blew in a flurry of leaves.
Get out!
Her eyes were like shadows. Her face was flushed and ugly red. On the doorstep, she took a half breath, as though she was about to say something more, then stopped. Her mouth twitched up in a cold little smile.
Aaron, wait. Before you do anything rash, I've got something to tell you.
Her voice was almost a whisper.
I know.
Know what? She leaned in so her lips were almost at his ear. He could smell the wine on her breath. I know your alibi for the day Ellie Deacon died was bullshit. Because I know where Luke was, and it wasn't with you.
Wait, Gretchen.
She gave him a shove.
Looks like we've all got our secrets, Aaron.
The door slammed. Chapter 34. It was a long walk back to town. Fork felt every step ricochet from the soles of his feet up to his pounding head. His thoughts swarmed like flies. He relived conversations he'd had with Gretchen, holding them up under this new stark light, examining them, seeking out the flaws. He phoned Rako. No answer. Perhaps he was still angry. Fork left a message, asked him to call. It was near closing time when he finally reached the Fleece. Scott Whitlam was on the pub steps, fastening his bike helmet. His injured nose looked better than it had the other night. Whitlam took one look at Fork's face and stopped.
You all right, mate?
Rough night.
Looks like it.
Whitlam took his helmet off.
Come on, I'll buy you a quick one.
Fork wanted nothing more than to crawl up the staircase to bed, but didn't have the energy to argue. He followed Whitlam inside. The bar was nearly empty and McMurdo was wiping the counter. He paused when they walked in and reached for two beer glasses without asking. Whitlam put his helmet on the counter.
I'll get these.
Put them on the tap, mate, he said to McMurdo. The barman frowned. No tap.
Come on, for a regular. Don't make me say it again, my friend.
Okay, fine. Whitlam pulled out his wallet and thumbed through it. I might be a bit... might have to put it on the card.
I'll get it.
Fork cut across him and put a 20 on the counter, waving away Whitlam's protestations. It's fine, forget it. Cheers. Fork took a deep swallow. The sooner it was drunk, the sooner he could call it a night. What's happened then? Whitlam asked. Oh, nothing. I'm just sick to death of this place. It hurt me. Luke hurt me. Any progress? Fork thought for a wild moment about telling him. McMurdo had stopped cleaning and was listening from behind the bar. In the end, he shrugged. I'll just be glad to get out of here. Whatever happened, he was due back in Melbourne on Monday. Sooner, if Rako got his way. Whitlam nodded. Half your luck. Although, he held up a hand and crossed his fingers, I might be following your lead sooner than I thought. You're leaving Kiwara? Hopefully, I've got something to do soon for Sandra. She's had it up here. I've been looking at a new place, a school up north maybe. Bit of a change. Weather's hotter up north. Yeah, at least they get the rains, Whitlam said. It's the lack of water here makes the whole town crazy. I'll drink to that, Fork said, draining his glass. His head felt heavy. Wine, beer, emotion. Whitlam took the hint and followed suit. All right, better run. It's a school night after all. Whitlam offered his hand. Hopefully I'll see you before you leave, but if not, good luck. Fork shook it. Thanks. You too. Up north. Whitlam left with a cheery wave and Fork handed the empty glasses to McMurdo. Did I hear you say you're heading out soon? Probably, Fork said. Well, I'll be sorry to see you go. Believe it or not, McMurdo said. You're the only one who reliably pays, which reminds me. He opened the cash register and gave Fork back his $20 note. I put the drinks on your room tab. Thought it would be easier to claim them on expenses or whatever you cops do. Fork took the 20, surprised. All right. Thanks. Thought you said no tabs. I only said that to Whitlam. You're all right, though. Fork frowned. But not Whitlam. You must know him well enough. McMurdo gave a short laugh. Oh, yeah. I know him well enough. That's why I also know where he keeps his money. He nodded to the poker machines flashing in the back room. Whitlam's a fan of the pokies, Fork asked. McMurdo nodded. And the rest. Horses, dogs. Always got one eye on the racing channel, the other on those apps on his phone. You're kidding. Fork was taken aback, but at the same time not surprised. He thought about the sports books in Whitlam's house. He'd come across a lot of gamblers in his career. There was no single type. The only thing they had in common was delusion and misery. He's subtle about it, but you see all sorts of things from behind a bar, McMurdo said. Especially when it comes to being able to pay for drinks. And I don't think he actually likes the pokies much. No? Nah, I get a sense they're small fry for him. Still doesn't stop him feeding his weight in gold coins into them every time he's here. That's what he was doing when he accidentally got clobbered the other night, when Jamie and Grant had their punch-up. Is that right? Anyway, I shouldn't be telling tales out of school, McMurdo said. There's nothing illegal about pissing your cash away, thank God. Otherwise I'd be out of business. So would a lot of people. Fork managed to smile. These gambling types are fair old suckers, though. Always looking for strategies and loopholes. End of the day, it only works if you back the right horse. Fork's room had never felt so much like a cell. He brushed his teeth without turning on the light and collapsed into bed. Despite the chaos in his head, he felt overwhelmed by exhaustion. Sleep was close. Out in the street, a tin can rolled along, its metallic clatter rattling in the quiet. Through his drowsiness, it reminded Fork of the artificial clang of the pokies. He closed his eyes. McMurdo was right about gambling. Like this case, sometimes all the strategies in the world couldn't help. It only works if you back the right horse. A cog turned deep in Fork's brain, lazily, because it was an ingrained one, crusted over and tough to shift. It reluctantly clunked one move over, then stopped, settled. Fork opened his eyes slowly. It was too dark to see anything, but he stared into the inky blackness, thinking. He pictured Kiwara laid out in three dimensions. He imagined himself climbing up to the lookout maybe, the scene below growing smaller the higher he went. When he reached the top, he looked down. Over the town, the drought, the Hadlers, noticing for the first time how things looked from a very different perspective. Fork thought about that with his eyes open, staring at the nothingness for long minutes, testing the cog in its new position. Finally, he sat up, fully awake now. He pulled on a t-shirt and slipped his feet into his trainers. He grabbed his torch and an old newspaper and crept downstairs and into the car park. His car was right where he'd left it. The stench of shit made his eyes water, but he barely noticed it. He peeled back the tarpaulin and, using the newspaper as a makeshift glove, popped open the boot. It was kept separate from the body of the car by the back seats and had been protected from the shitstorm. Fork clicked on the torch and shone it into the empty boot. He stood there for a long time. Then he pulled out his mobile and took a photo. Back in his room, sleep took a long time to come. When morning broke, he woke and dressed early, then waited impatiently. The moment the clock ticked over to 9 o'clock, Fork picked up the phone and made a single call. Luke Hadler's palms were sweating on the steering wheel. The air conditioner was on overdrive but had barely made a dent since he'd left Jamie Sullivan's place. His throat was dry and he wished he had a bottle of water to hand. He made himself focus on the road ahead. He was nearly home. Just get there. He had turned into the final stretch when he saw the figure up ahead, standing by the road, all alone, waving. Chapter 35. Fork clattered into the station, panting. He had hung up the phone and run all the way from the pub. It was a smoke screen. Rako looked up from his desk. His eyes were bloodshot and he still had sleep in the corner of one. What was? The whole thing, mate. It was never about Luke. Great, Luke muttered as he drove closer, his heart sinking as he was able to make out who was waving. For a moment he wondered if he could keep going, but it was a scorching day. It had to have touched 40 earlier, he reckoned. He hesitated a moment longer, then touched the brake and brought the ute to a stop. He wound down the window and leaned out. Fork opened the Hadler's file with shaking fingers, both excited and frustrated with himself. We've been tying ourselves in knots trying to find connections to Luke, what he was hiding, who wanted him dead, and what have we ended up with? Nothing. Well, nothing substantial. Lots of minor motives, but not enough. And you were right. Was I? I did have tunnel vision, but we both did. We've been backing the wrong horse the whole time. Looks like you got some trouble here. Luke leaned out. He nodded at the object lying at the person's feet. Thanks, I think so. Have you got any tools on you? Luke killed the engine and climbed out. He crouched down to look more closely. What's gone wrong? They were the last words Luke Hadler spoke, as a heavy weight smashed into the back of his skull. There was a wet thud and a sudden stunned silence as all around the birds in their trees were shocked mute. Breathing raggedly as he towered over Luke Hadler's slumped form, Scott Whitlam looked down at what he had done. Fork rummaged through the file and pulled out a photocopy of Karen Hadler's library receipt. The word Grant stood out above Fork's own phone number. He pushed the page across Rako's desk and stabbed it with a finger. Grant. For God's sake, it's not a bloody name. Karen shut the door to the principal's office behind her, muffling the everyday sounds of the Wednesday afternoon bustle. She was wearing a red and white apple print dress and she looked worried. She chose the seat closest to Scott Whitlam's desk and sat straight backed with her feet neatly crossed at the ankles. Scott, she began, I wasn't sure about coming to speak to you about this, but there is a problem and I can't turn a blind eye to it. She leaned in, cautious, embarrassed even, and handed over a piece of paper. On the letterhead, the Crossley Educational Trust logo stood out against the white background. Karen peered up from under her blonde fringe, her eyes looking for one thing, reassurance. Somewhere in the deepest fight-or-flight part of Scott Whitlam's brain, a hidden door cracked open, and offered the briefest glimpse of just how far he was prepared to go to stop her. Grant, Fork said, pointing at the diary, also known as a bursary, a fund, a windfall, a financial gift, like the kind Kiwara Primary applied for from the Crossley Educational Trust last year. And their claim was rejected, except, guess what? Rako blinked in disbelief. You're kidding. I'm not. I was on the phone this morning to the head of the trust, and Kiwara Primary was successfully awarded a financial grant of $50,000 this year. In hindsight, Whitlam could pinpoint the singular moment when he blew it. He had picked up the page branded with its telltale letterhead and examined it. It was a form survey, sent automatically to successful grant recipients to gather feedback on the submissions process. It wasn't much of a smoking gun, which meant there was probably more paperwork, he guessed. Other things that she'd kept back. Karen was giving him a chance to explain or confess. Whitlam could tell by the way she looked at him, with those blue eyes begging for a reasonable answer. He should have said, yeah, strange, I'll look into it. Perhaps we've been lucky after all. Jesus, he should have thanked her. That's what he should have done. Instead, he'd panicked. He didn't take enough time to read the letter before dismissing it. It was never going to be an easy game for him to win, but it was at that moment that he lost. Snake eyes, all over Red Rover. It'll be nothing, Whitlam had said, sealing his fate with those words. A mistake, ignore it. But the mistake was his. He could tell by the way her back stiffened and she cast her eyes down, distancing herself. If she hadn't known for sure when she walked in, she knew it as she walked out. Karen Hadler's goodbye as she left was as dry as the fields. Scott Whitlam, Rako said. Shit. Shit. Does that work? Yeah, it works. He's got a gambling problem, I found out last night. Falk told him what McMurdo had said. That's what tipped me off. Something McMurdo said made me realise we'd been looking in the wrong direction the whole time. So what are we talking? Stealing funds from the school for what? Bad debts? Rako said. Could well be. Whitlam turns up last year from the city. No connection to the place. Sticks around even though he clearly hates it. He told me some story about a mugging gone wrong back in Melbourne. A stranger got stabbed. I wouldn't be surprised if there was more to that than he says. They were silent for a moment. Jesus, poor Karen, Rako said. We're idiots, Fork said. We discounted her far too quickly. Her and Billy. We thought they were collateral damage. Luke was always the main player. He always attracted the attention. Ever since we were kids, he was the perfect cover. How could anything ever be about his boring wife when it could be about Luke? Christ. Rako closed his eyes, running through the case as they knew it, shaking his head as pieces dropped into place. Karen wasn't being stalked by Grant Dow. She wasn't afraid of her husband. If anything, Luke was probably worried about what she thought she'd discovered at the school. You think she told him? I think she must have, Fork said. Why else would she have my phone number? Karen went straight from Whitlam's office to the girls' toilets. She locked herself in a cubicle and put her forehead against the door before she let the angry tears come. Right up until that meeting, there had been a glimmer of hope. She'd wanted Whitlam to look at the letter and laugh. Ah, see exactly what's happened, he'd say, before explaining it in a way that made perfect sense. She'd been desperate for him to say that, and he hadn't. Karen wiped her eyes with a shaky hand. What now? Part of her still couldn't quite believe Scott had stolen that money, even though she now knew it to be true. She'd known it before if she admitted it to herself. She'd gone through the account records herself. The errors that had cropped up were his, not hers. A trail of breadcrumbs exposing his deceit, his theft. She tried the word out. It felt so wrong. Karen believed suspicion was not the same as certainty. But her husband's view of the world had always been more black and white. Babe, if you think the bastards nicked the money, then call the cops and report it. I'll report it if you don't want to, Luke had said 2 nights ago. Karen had been sitting up in bed, a new library book open across her lap. She wasn't getting very far with it. She watched her husband take his clothes off and throw them in a heap on a chair. He stood there naked and arched his broad back as he yawned. He flashed her a sleepy smile, and she was struck by how lovely he looked in the half light. They spoke in whispers so the sound didn't carry to the kids' rooms. "No, Luke," she'd said, "don't interfere, please. I can do it myself, but I want to be sure, then I'll report it." Part of her knew she was being overcautious, but the school's principal was part of the bedrock of the community. Karen could imagine how the parents would react. Tempers were so fraught, a part of her worried they might actually harm him. She couldn't let loose an accusation of that scale without solid proof. Kiwara was fragile enough as it was. This had to be done right. Then there was her job to consider. She'd lose that in a heartbeat if she was wrong. "I should talk to Scott first," Karen said as her husband climbed in next to her and put a warm hand on her thigh. "Give him a chance to explain."
"Give him a chance to hide it, more like. Karen, babe, let the cops handle it."
She was silent, mutinous. Luke sighed.
"All right. If you won't report it, at least get some advice on getting whatever this proof is you think you need."
Luke rolled over and reached out for his mobile phone. He scrolled through until he found a contact and passed the phone to Karen. "Call this guy, that friend of mine who's a cop. He does something with money with the feds in Melbourne. He's a good bloke, really smart. Plus he kind of owes me one. You can trust him, he'll help you." Karen Hadler didn't say anything. She had told Luke she would sort it out, and she would. But it was late and easier not to argue. She found a pen among the clutter on her bedside table and picked up the first piece of paper to hand, the library receipt she was using for a bookmark. That would do. She turned it over and wrote a single word of reminder before copying down Aaron Falk's number. Then, because her husband was still watching, she tucked it carefully into the book she was reading and placed it by the bed. "So it won't get lost," she said, turning off the lamp and lying back against the pillow. "Call him," Luke said as he reached out and slipped his arms around his wife in the quiet night. "Aaron will know what to do." Chapter 36. 90 minutes later, Falk and Reiko watched the school from the front seat of the station's unmarked police car. They were parked up a hill on a side street, their vantage point offering a decent view of the main building and front playground. The back door of the car opened and Constable Barnes climbed inside. He jogged up the hill and was out of breath. He leaned through the gap between the front seats and held out his palm, proudly displaying 2 brand new Remington shots. Reiko picked up the ammunition and inspected the make. He nodded. It was the same brand found in the bodies of Luke, Karen and Billy Hadler. Forensics could probably match it more closely, but for now, that was good enough. "It was locked away in the caretaker's shed, like he said." Barnes was almost bouncing in his seat. "Any trouble getting in?" Falk asked. Barnes tried and failed to look modest. "I went direct to the caretaker, used the old routine inspection line. Licenses, safety bullshit. He let me straight in. Too easy. I managed to find enough wrong that he'll keep it to himself. Said I'd turn a blind eye if he got it sorted before my next visit. He'll be telling no one."
"Good work," said Reiko. "As long as he doesn't tell Whitlam for a few hours, we'll be right. Back up from Clyde's about 40 minutes away."
"I don't see why we don't just roll in there and lift the bastard," Barnes grumbled from the back seat. "Clyde hasn't done anything to deserve the credit."
Reiko looked over.
"We'll get credit where it's due, mate. Don't worry," he said. "They're not going to get much glory for securing his house and grabbing his bank statements."
"I wish they'd hurry up then," Barnes said.
"Yeah, me too," Falk said.
All 3 turned back to stare at the building in the distance. A bell rang and the school doors opened. A gaggle of children trickled out, forming groups, running around, reveling in their temporary freedom. Behind them, Falk could make out a figure leaning against the main doorway. Hat on, coffee mug in hand, a flash of red tie visible against his shirt. Scott Whitlam. Falk felt Barnes shift behind him.
$50,000. It's a grubby amount to kill three people over, Barnes said.
It'll be less about the money than you'd think, Fawkes said. Gamblers like him are always chasing something else. I've seen it get pretty desperate pretty fast. I think every roll of the dice is a second chance. The question is, what was Whitlam chasing?
Doesn't matter what it was. Can't justify this, Barnes said.
No, but that's money for you, Fawkes said. It can get bloody disgusting.
Whitlam stood in the school doorway, cradling his mug between his hands. The wind was up again. He felt the dust stick to the sweat on his skin. The kids shrieked and ran in the playground in front of him, and he wondered if he could start to breathe again. A couple of days and Fawkes would be gone, maybe sooner with any luck. He would breathe then, he decided, not before. A few more months. Keep his head down, keep his luck up, and he could disappear to that job up north. Part of him couldn't believe he'd made it to this point. He'd nearly had a heart attack when Rako had mentioned they had security footage from the Hadler's farm. He'd had no idea the farmhouse had a camera, and he'd sat in a cold sweat between the two cops as he contemplated how near he'd come to being discovered. He had to get away from here. He would have to convince Sandra to give him one last chance, one more fresh start, and this time he would stop gambling. He promised. He had said the words to her last night, and through his tears, he'd felt that for the first time, he really meant them. She had watched in silence. She'd heard those words before. Right before they'd moved to Kiwara, and at least twice before that. But this time he had to make her believe it. More than that, he told himself, he had to do it. He had to stop. Because this time there was so much more at risk than he could bear to lose. Just the thought of it made his guts churn. Sandra was so worried. And yet she had no idea of the real weight of the axe dangling over them. She thought having a bank account constantly in the red was the worst of her problems. The secret shame of having to buy the weekly groceries on credit cards. Having to keep up appearances behind a veneer of rented houses and hire purchase coffee machines. She thought the problems ran day to day, but not much further. She didn't know about the trail of debts that stretched from here to Melbourne, or the horrors waiting for her and their daughter at the end of that trail if he didn't pay. Whitlam almost smiled, a wild, loopy grin at the idea of telling her the truth. The promise of the nail gun alone would be enough to send her racing up north. They had delivered the message to his house, here in Kiwara. Two thick-necked steroid junkies from Melbourne, showing up on his tidy, suburban-like doorstep in person to tell him their boss was getting twitchy. Pay. They'd brought the nail gun with them to show him. Whitlam had been paralysed with fear. Sandra and Danielle were in the house. He could hear the sounds of his wife and daughter chatting idly in the kitchen as the two men detailed in low tones what they were going to do to them if he didn't come up with the cash. It was a horrific soundtrack. The notification of the Crossley Educational Trust funding had come through 2 days later. The letter was addressed to Whitlam directly. It had arrived with the claim form on Karen's day off and landed on his desk unopened. He'd made the decision in less than a heartbeat. They gave away millions. $50,000 was a drop in the ocean for those rich bastards. He could earmark it for something vague and tricky to quantify. Training courses, perhaps. Support programs. That would tick their boxes. For a while. But that was all he needed. A while. Borrow it now to pay Melbourne. Repay it, well, later. Somehow. It wasn't enough to clear his debt, not by a long way, but it was enough to buy him some breathing space. He hadn't let himself think about it too closely as he diverted the money. He'd simply swapped the school's account details for his private one, the one Sandra didn't know about. He kept the school's account name on the form. Banks used only the numbers, not the names. Whether the two corresponded was never checked, he knew. The plan had been okay, he told himself. Not great, not even good, but holding water. Then Karen Hadler had knocked on his door one afternoon holding that Crossley Trust form. Whitlam remembered the look in her eyes and, making a fist, he lightly, discreetly punched the wall next to him until his knuckles were raw and weeping. Whitlam watched Karen leave. As his office door clicked closed behind her, he rotated in his chair and silently vomited into the waste paper bin. He could not go to prison. He couldn't pay off what he owed in prison, and the people he owed weren't the kind to care about why. Pay, or his family paid. That was the deal, signed and sealed. He had seen the nail gun. They'd made him touch it, feel its leaden weight in his hand. Pay, or his... No, there was no alternative. He would pay. Of course he would pay. He sat alone in his office and forced himself to think. Karen knew, which meant she'd probably tell her husband if she hadn't told him already. How soon would she blow the whistle? She was a cautious woman, almost overly diligent in many ways. It slowed her down. Karen Hadler would want to be 100% certain before she committed herself to action. Luke, however, was a different story. He didn't have much time. He couldn't let this get out. He could not let this get out. There was no alternative. The end of the school day came and went, but brought with it no real answer. Whitlam waited as long as he could, then did what he always did in times of stress. He took all the cash he had, and some he didn't, and went to the pub's pokey room. It was there, cocooned in the glow of the lights and the optimistic jangling sounds, that the first stirrings of a solution came to him, as they so often did. Alone and tucked out of sight among the pokies, Whitlam heard Luke Hadler's voice from a table round the corner. He froze, hardly daring to breathe, as he waited for Hadler to tell Jamie Sullivan about the school money. He felt sure it was coming, but the secret remained unsaid. Instead, they bitched about rabbits, planned a shoot on Sullivan's land the following day. Times were arranged. Luke would bring his own shotgun. Interesting, Whitlam thought. Perhaps the game was not quite over. Not yet. Another $100 in gold coins pushed through the machine and he had the skeleton of a plan. He ran it over and over in his head until there was some flesh on the bones. It was okay. Not perfect. Not a sure thing. But maybe 50-50. And Whitlam would take those odds any day of the week. Down in the playground, Whitlam watched as a group of tiny children hurtled past him, his own daughter in the mix. For a second, he thought he saw Billy Hadler in the crowd, not for the first time. Whitlam's head jerked involuntarily, a sort of spasm from the neck. He still felt sick when he thought about the boy, for what it was worth. Billy was never supposed to be there. Whitlam's scraped fist clenched around the coffee cup as he made his way back to his office. The boy was supposed to be out of the house. It was all arranged. He'd made sure. He'd deliberately dug out that badminton set. After that, it had needed only a subtle suggestion from him for Sandra to get on the phone and organise that last-minute playdate with Billy. If the boy's stupid mother hadn't cancelled, stuffed up the plan, then Billy wouldn't have been caught up in it. She only had herself to blame. Whitlam himself had tried to save that kid. No one could say any different. He took a swig of coffee and winced as the liquid burned his mouth. He felt it trickle down his gullet, turning his insides sour. Guts writhing, Whitlam had left the pub and passed a sleepless night picking holes in his plan. The next day he sat in his office in a blank-eyed stupor, waiting for the inevitable knock on the door. Karen would have spoken up. Surely. Someone would come. He just didn't know who it would be. The police? The school board chairman, Karen herself again, perhaps. He both feared and longed for that knock. A knock meant Karen had told. It meant it was too late, and he wouldn't have to do what he was planning. He didn't need to ask himself if he could go through with it. He knew he could. He'd proved it with the guy in the Footscray Alley. That was a guy who should have known better. He was supposed to be a professional. Whitlam had come across him once before. Then, the man had cornered him in a car park, relieved him of his wallet, and delivered his message via a sharp blow to the kidneys. It was supposed to play out the same in Footscray, Whitlam guessed. But then the man had grown angry, started waving the knife around and demanding more than they'd agreed. Things got messy fast. The guy had been sloppy, and almost certainly under the influence of something. He'd heard the word teacher and underestimated Whitlam's athleticism. A poorly timed lunge was countered with a lucky rugby tackle, and they hit the concrete with a crack. The blade had flashed orange in the streetlight, and Whitlam felt the point slice across his belly, leaving a warm red line. Adrenaline and fear rushed through him as he grabbed the man's knife hand. He held and twisted it, using his own weight to force it back towards his attacker's torso. The man wouldn't drop the knife. He was still holding it as it slipped into his own body. He grunted wetly into Whitlam's face as the teacher pinned him down, feeling the slowing rhythm of the blood pumping out onto the road. He had waited until the man had stopped breathing, then waited a full minute more. Whitlam had had tears in his eyes. His body was trembling and he was terrified he might pass out, but somewhere, buried many layers down, was a pinpoint of calm. He'd been driven into a corner and he'd acted. He'd done what was needed. Whitlam, so familiar with the sick, free-falling sensation every time he reached for his wallet, had, for once, been in control. With shaking fingers, he'd examined his own torso. The cut was superficial. It looked far worse than it was. He bent over his attacker and dutifully performed two rounds of CPR, making sure his fingerprints smeared in blood reflected his civic actions. He found a house in a neighbouring street with its lights on and let forth the emotion he'd been holding back as he asked them to report a mugging. The attackers had fled, but quick, please, someone was badly injured. Whenever Whitlam now thought about the incident, which was more often than he expected, he knew it had been an act of self-defense. This new threat may involve an office rather than an alleyway, paper instead of a knife. But at its heart, he felt it was not so different. The guy in the lane? Karen, on the other side of the desk, forcing his hand, compelling him to act. It came down to them or him. And Whitlam chose himself. The end of the school day came and went. The classrooms and playground cleared. No one came knocking on the office door. She hadn't reported it yet. He could still salvage this. It was now, or it was never. He looked at the clock. It was now. Chapter 37. How did Whitlam get to the Hadler's farm? Barnes asked, leaning forward between the front seats. We turned our eyes square watching that school CCTV footage and I thought his car didn't move from the school parking lot the whole afternoon. Falk found the photos of Luke's body sprawled in his ute's cargo tray. He pulled up the close-cropped shot of the four horizontal streaks on the tray's interior. He passed it to Barnes, along with his phone showing the photos he'd taken of his own car boot the night before. On the boot's felt-up holstery were two long stripes. Barnes looked from one to the other. The marks are the same, he said. What are they? The ones in my boot are new, Falk said. They're tire streaks. He rode there on his bloody bike. Whitlam didn't tell anyone in the front office he was going. He slipped out of the fire door unseen, leaving his jacket on his chair and his computer switched on. The universal symbol for on the premises back in a tick. He nipped out to the sheds, avoiding the limited range of the two cameras. Thank God for lack of funding, he caught himself thinking, then almost laughed at the irony. Within minutes, Whitlam had unlocked the ammunition store and pocketed a handful of shots. The school had a single shotgun for rabbit control, which he placed in a sports bag and slung over his shoulder. He would only use that as a last resort. Luke Hadler would have his own gun, Whitlam begged silently.